Cirque du Soleil is a corporation as significant to the Las Vegas Strip as any of the casino resort companies who own properties there. 21 years ago, the first resident show on the Strip opened at the Mirage. That was Mystère. In the intervening years, Cirque du Soleil opened one hit show after another. There are now 8 resident shows on the Strip, and the Cirque brand has become synonymous with Las Vegas entertainment. But not everything Cirque touches has turned to gold. The company suffered during the recession, had to shutter one show, Elvis, and the company experienced tragedy last year with the death of one of its aerialist performers. With us to talk about the past and future of the company is Jerry Nadal. He's Senior Vice President of Cirque du Soleil's Resident Shows Division. Jerry, welcome. It's great to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
We should note, by the way, for the record, Jerry Nadal is a longtime member of the Nevada Public Radio Board of Directors. Let's talk a little bit about Cirque's longevity. I mean, it's 21 years now since Mystère first opened. Why has the company done so well here and become such a substantial part of Las Vegas entertainment? What's the key?
Well, I think if you go back in history, I think entertainment has always been central to the Las Vegas offering. I think that entertainment tends to be cyclical type of entertainment that's offered. I think we came in right as the this latest incarnation of Las Vegas started when the Mirage opened. So Siegfried and Roy started that. And then shortly after that, we came in with Mystère, as you mentioned, in 1993. So 21 years. We're coming up on our 10,000th performance of Mystère on December 27th, by the way. And one of our performers in there, Bruce Rickard, guitarist, has not missed a single performance in 21 years.
All 10,000 of
so
them to be?
Yeah, so we contacted the Guinness Book of Records, and he's going to be in it.
He's
so,
going to be there.
Yeah, yeah. So it's fantastic. So I think that it was it's a big, huge spectacle, kind of like the big Folies Bergère and the Showgirl shows were back in their day. And we're glad to see that Jubilee is still going strong on the Strip. But I think it is all cyclical, and I think it touched a nerve with people, the big, spectacular shows, lots of human feats, and no language to speak of.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. It seems to me that one of the fascinating parts of the story is that the shows do not rely on dialogue. They're music and action-oriented. People who do not speak English or are uncomfortable with it can watch them and follow everything as well.
By and large. So you're really touching people on an emotional level with the shows. I mean, they are based in circus art. So you go back to traditional circus, there's no real language spoken there either. I mean, Ringling has the ring, you know, the ringmasters, right? We don't necessarily do that. So I think you can have people from multiple countries seeing that. So they're reacting to the shows on an emotional level. So you don't really need a language. There's no language barrier, which is great for us.
Yeah. No, and with the, along with the emotions, you've got the dramatic intensities. There's humor, there's romance, there's mystery. And yet, again, not necessarily classic plots or storylines that resolve. So there's maybe a dreamlike quality would be the best way to describe a lot of the shows, at least certainly the classic ones. That's become part of the kind of the classic Cirque motif, hasn't it?
It has become part of the Cirque motif. And I think if you go back to our owner, Guy La Liberté, he's involved in every one of the creations. And it is designed like a show. So you look at where your high points and your low points. You want to bring the audience up, you know, and with some of the big action items. And then you're going to bring them down. You want something that's maybe a little bit more touching. The clowns certainly add humor. There's a lot of debate about the clowns in any of the shows. There are ones that are like slapstick. We have others that are more in the European style of clowning. But all of that to give the audience at high and low, you know, a feminine touch with or a masculine touch. So they're really designed with all of that in mind.
Debate over the clowns?
Well, do you like clowns, Dave?
Well, yeah. I mean, I mean, is that the part of it where
there was a lot of debate about clowns, and we don't do the one thing we don't do is we don't do clowning, as in we look at people at work as clowns, and then we bring them into the shows, look at what they have to offer. So it's other people's material really that we're using, and we see how we can fit that in from an emotional level, what we're trying to do with the show.
So you guys you're sensitive to the idea, or you can sometimes be sensitive to the idea that some people just don't like or
absolutely
are scared of clowns.
Yeah.
You sort of take that into account as you're designing shows.
Well, we know that that's the case, but I think that's a central part of it. We're a circus arts organization by and large, so clowning is central to just about all of our shows.
The show that's been here the longest is one we were talking about a moment ago, Mystère. 21 years old, 10,000 shows as of the late December. Is there any possibility that it could close someday to make way for new productions?
I think it's still doing really well. It's still making a hefty profit. We're about to come up on our $1 billionth in sales for Mystère after 21 years. It shows no signs of slowing down. There are no plans to close any of the shows right now.
You've been working on a series of makeovers. And then, you know, once in a while, you do some things to kind of freshen up individual shows. What's an example of material that worked maybe two decades ago that needed to be removed or modified with a show like Mystère?
Well, Mystère's gone through a couple. You know, I think we've made a lot recently. We're doing some like concerted effort on the shows where we're making a lot of changes at the same time. But our shows have changed over the period of time. So when we first opened, we had a rhythmic gymnastic number in there. It was a manipulation number. Three guys kind of in long skirts with these curved metal trays, as it were, flipping balls around their heads and on the trays. And that came out another...
Why did you decide to take that out?
Well, we look at what the audience reacts to. We also look at what people... But people come into the shows with their own acts as well, and we also adjust them. We don't always design all of our own material. So they came to the end of their contract and perhaps did not want to renew. So we look at what else is out there that could fill that slot from an emotional level. What are we doing with the show? Where does it fit in the show? Is it a high-energy act? Is it a single-person act? A duo, a trio act. So all of that always changes.
Do you ever see things and look at them and think, these are actually kind of dated?
We look at
that all the time. Is that part of the decision-making?
Yeah, we have that. We're not just dated. It's like it's been there. We have a huge repeat business in our show. So part of the effort you're seeing on our part now is with the changing demographics, as we've come out of the recession, it's gotten younger here. The audience over the last, or just our overall visitation level in the city has dropped by close to 5 years. So a younger crowd coming in. So you're always looking at how you have to change things and appeal to the demographic of the people that are here now.
Cirque was hit like every other business in Nevada by the recession. How did you have to adjust? Did performances get leaner? Did you have to look at lowering costs of shows and think, these are really dinging us right now?
We looked overall at how we were structured, because as we've added our shows over the years, we tended to replicate what we did from one show to the next with like the number of crew people based on the number of acts in the show. And those vary. These are big shows, as you mentioned. So what we did was go through and say, when we were opening Michael Jackson, let's say 2 years ago, we knew we had to hire about 100 more crew guys on there. So what we did was we worked with MGM and said, can we take a look at our day maintenance crews, which were specific to each show, and we centralized them. So we were able to eliminate 75 positions, but not necessarily people, because we were hiring 100 on Michael Jackson at the time. So, I mean, there was a huge cost savings there. Looked at the number of performers in the show. Did we need that many performers?
Yeah. Did you have to cut back on
any performers? We cut a few performers here and there. Not tremendously, but we did cut back because we added over the years. We have on-call performers. So, you know, it's like any business. You have to go back in and take a look at what you've done, and does it still make sense?
How do you weigh cutting things like that, particularly on stage, the talent and such, when sometimes the size of the spectacle demands a large cast? I would imagine
we didn't cut back on any of the shows. I mean, I think the most we cut back was 4 performers on any given show. So we probably reduced the performing ranks by about 20 across 8 shows. So I'm not sure that it would be really recognizable to an audience member, but, you know, everybody has a cost associated with it. Same thing with the technical staff, our backstage, or administrative staff. So we just looked at took a healthy review of all of that and said, what could we do it without compromising what the audience is going to see on stage, and certainly not compromising our safety standards.
Has Cirque in Las Vegas fully recovered from the recession?
Yeah, I think it's a new dynamic now. We've had to figure out how we're going after people that are coming to town, and what are they interested in. We've played around with our show times. We've played around with our We have new dark day schedules coming out. Every show has 2 days a week off right now. So we hadn't really adjusted our schedule in the past 2 to 3 years. So we looked at that because it's different from one end of the strip to the next, the dynamic of visitation and what the properties are generating, whether it's more leisure, more conference, convention business. So we've taken a really good look at all of that as well.
We're talking with Jerry Nadal. He is the Senior Vice President of Cirque du Soleil's Resident Shows Division. He is also, we should note, Vice Chairman of Nevada Public Radio's Board of Directors. A while back, you had to shutter one of your resident shows, Viva Elvis. It was the first time since Cirque opened resident shows here that occurred. Looking back, why did you need to do that? What led to that?
Hindsight is always a wonderful
sure,
thing,
of course,
isn't it?
Of course.
But you really got to go back and look at it. So when we decided to do an Elvis show, I think everybody thought it was kind of a no-brainer, that this was the right market for an Elvis-themed show, given Elvis's history with the city. We opened the show kind of, I call it was a perfect storm. It was opening at City Center, which, as you know, struggled to get to the finish line on opening. So we did not necessarily have a $5 million marketing launch budget that we've had in the past to launch a show. It was right smack dead in the middle of the depths of the recession. So I don't know that people were, you know, we were struggling as it was at that time. So to be opening a new show with a minimal ad budget to get it out of the gate was difficult. The show was critically well received by just about all of the papers and news outlets that came. But I didn't resonate with the audience. We realized.
Why do you think that is? I mean, Elvis, as you said, Elvis has got the Las Vegas connection, and of course, he's always going to have fans.
He does have fans, but we realize that it also shows tend to fit the properties that they're in. I don't think City Center is bringing in a much younger clientele, a little more dynamic clientele. And we were looking at who was in the theater, and it was an older crowd, even for us. I mean, our typical audience is between 35 and 50, right? Our kind of sweet spot for people that come, the biggest chunk of our audience. This was an audience that was well into their 70s. And we realized, doing a lot of research after the fact, that Elvis, popular as he is and or was, his audience was aging out with him, as opposed to a Michael Jackson or a Beatles, where they've stayed contemporary generation to generation. Elvis didn't write any of his own music. He covered everybody else's music, or songs were written for him but were since covered by other people. So I just think we underestimated the brand association with Elvis and Cirque. It was also very much around like a Broadway show. For us, it was heavy on dance, not as much on acrobatics, a little bit more of a straightforward proscenium presentation. So all of those things combined, I just think we... In another time period, maybe at another property, the show would have had a better chance. But I just think it was there was a lot working against it when we look back at it.
Yeah. Were there things that those older attendees just did not like about the show?
They loved it. There just wasn't enough of them to come see it.
Not enough of them. Yeah.
We would love to have 1,870-plus people a night in the theater. There just wasn't enough people to go around for it that wanted to see Elvis.
Yeah. Was it hard for Cirque directors and choreographers to collaborate with the Presley family? Because I know the Presley estate had to sign off on everything.
No, they were actually, it was Bob Silliman's company, SFX, at the time, that they had acquired the rights to, the majority of the rights to the Elvis brand and image. So they were actually quite easy to deal with. Priscilla Presley, primarily, and somewhat Lisa Marie, were very easy. They brought us a lot of information, all the backstory, the back history, same as when we had worked with the Beatles. Again, they were they're obviously very protective of him and the brand. The same way the Beatles were protective of that brand. So we've had an interesting experience with all three estates that we've dealt with, Michael Jackson's, Elvis's, and with the Beatles.
Was there any part of Elvis's life that was off limits? Lisa Marie or Priscilla said, no, don't do that.
We chose to say we were going to celebrate his legacy, musical legacy. So, you know, I think we didn't delve into the personal. It was part of it. As you saw the progression in the show of his movie career, his dating Priscilla, having Lisa Marie. There was family footage in there, videos that were not accessible prior to them giving that to us, and we presented in the show. We looked at his military career. So we celebrated the high points of his life, so we didn't get into any of the darker stuff that, you know, there's enough written about that, and we're providing entertainment.
What did you learn from the failure of Viva Elvis? And I'm curious to know how you rolled those lessons, things you learned, into the Michael Jackson One show.
Well, I think that... there's always a takeaway. You know, an ingredient of success is failure. So, you know, and we've had primarily successes over the years, and we've had a few failures as well, which, you know, as Gia said, he goes, I don't mind failing. I just don't want to do it twice. I don't want to make the same mistake twice. So I think we looked at that and said, okay, we needed to do much more on our end in the way of market research. I think we just really took it at face value, saying Elvis and Vegas were synonymous, and let's do a show about Elvis. And we went out, put the right creatives in place, and it just didn't hit. So I think Michael Jackson was also, we thought, a no-brainer as well, but we did a lot more market research, worked with the estate on what material was available to us, what we could use, how we would present it.
Yeah, give us an example of something in Michael Jackson 1 that was a result of that research, things you learned from that research.
Taking a look at, again, celebrating the music, celebrating his musical legacy. We didn't really, it was really more about the music. There was less personal in there. With Elvis, it was the personal was really tied into the music. So there was a lot more home video footage. Elvis came off a little bit more like a tribute show. I think Michael Jackson evokes more of the memory. But, you know, and that's a further cry from even what we did with the Beatles, which was much more impressionistic. There is no actual visuals of the Beatles in that show.
Are you far enough along at this point with Michael Jackson 1 that you can look at it and say it's a success?
It's a wild success. Yeah, we're very happy with it. The audience is happy with it.
You don't have to worry about that anymore.
No, and there's some great special effects in that show, like with the hologram that we have that just, we have people that leave the theater crying every night.
Ticket sales are great for it?
Ticket sales are great. Yes, everybody's happy.
And except for, well, including the people who are crying, presumably.
Yes, exactly.
We're talking with Jerry Nadal, Senior Vice President of Cirque du Soleil's Resident Shows Division. In 2013, you had a tragedy. An aerialist, Sergio Guillard, fell to her death during the final battle scene of Ka. It seemed like the whole town went into shock when that happened. Talk a little bit about her death, how her death affected morale inside the company.
Oh, it devastated people, particularly here in Las Vegas. And, you know, and for us, it was opening night of Michael Jackson. So the timing was horrific. Anytime something like that happens, you know, we really thought we had, and we still do think we have one of the best safety records in the industry. So you think we had a tragic deck there. Since we've opened here, we've had over 37,000 performances. You know, we do each one of those shows 470-plus times a year. So we had provisions in place. We have a huge technical team in place. But that night ended up being a perfect storm of some human error on her part, some human error on the technical part. And then that resulted in a failure of equipment. What happened with the equipment was never designed to happen. It was never envisioned that something like that would happen, that she came up and she hit the bottom of the grid, which caused a shock wave to go up through the system and caused the pulley to jump, the cable to jump a pulley, creating a pinch point to cut the cable. None of that was envisioned. So we kicked the show down 2 weeks after that. We worked with OSHA. It's interesting. We had brought OSHA in years before that. We had one of our guys on staff that was appointed by the governor to the OSHA review board here in the state based on our safety record and track record in that, because after the accidents at SeaWorld and some other high-profile accidents that have happened, federal OSHA started looking at regulating the entertainment industry, and we thought, well, we wanted to be right in the middle of that, because I think we've set a number of standards along with Disney. It's the only other company I can think of that has quite the safety standards and record that we have. So we wanted to be very involved in all that. So
once that happened, what were you seeing and hearing from Las Vegas-based Cirque performers and members?
Well, people couldn't believe that it happened, and we got literally messages from around the country and from around the world. I mean, we had a lot of support because a lot of people felt, wow, if something like that could happen at Cirque, what's happening and where I'm working? You know, that maybe there isn't that kind of focus on safety. So I think people really were in shock, as you mentioned earlier.
Give us an example, if you can, of how that was affecting the performers here.
Well, the first thing we did was, after being up all night at the theater, OSHA came in right away, started the investigation. I sat with our VP of creative and my VP of operations, Callum Pearson, and we said, okay, we know what we're dealing with here. We know that we're going to take the show down for a couple of weeks until we absolutely know what happens, because then it's about building people's confidence back up to, I mean, in that theater in particular, everything, there's no edges, it's all open space. But we went around to every theater the next day, talked to every cast and crew about what had happened, what we knew at the time up to what had happened, and we told everybody that was in the air doing an aerial act that if they questioned their safety even remotely, that we did not expect them to perform that evening. And I think, to the person, everybody was back in their shows the next night, which was amazing. But we went, then we had to go through and figure out, we want to make sure that we didn't have any other situation in any other theater that could potentially happen that we didn't envision when the show was originally designed. So we brought back all of our third-party contractors. We brought back all of our external vendors, like Silver State Wire Roping came in. And when we brought the cast back slowly, we did some seminars and we made everybody sit through every piece of equipment that's in the theater, every rope, every wire. They explained exactly how it was manufactured, what the tensile strength of it was, what the safety recommendations were for it for being a replacement. Like a cable can go through 10,000 cycles, let's say. They let everybody know that with our safety protocols, we were replacing them after 500 cycles, so well ahead of whatever the manufacturer was suggesting. Just so we had to go through and make sure that we had all the T's crossed and the I's dotted, and this really was a one-off occurrence. But, you know, we went back through with a fine-tooth comb to make sure that everything was the way it was supposed to be in every theater.
Sir canceled this battle scene for a time, and then this past December 12th, you brought it back to Ka. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, it's an integral part of the show. I mean, I think that the show really comes up to that. You know, it's the whole good-evil thing going on through the whole show. So, I mean, that's the climactic scene in the show and really is it's the high point of it for what it is. It's like watching a massive video game play out in front of you. That's the way it's been described by a lot of people. So we knew that we wanted to bring it back. The performers wanted to go back on it. That was the one area we spent the most time on, looking at how it was designed, how it was installed, how we could prevent what happening again. Where the performers were always in control of their own acceleration and deceleration on handheld controllers in that scene. Now we have computer programming with redundancy, so once they start to exit the scene and they get out past a certain point, they no longer have control of their own controller. The computers take over. It's a controlled ascent out or descent out. So That, frankly, wasn't available to us 10 years ago when we opened the show.
Did you talk originally with the performer's family before deciding to restore the scene?
We were in contact with her family through the whole, you know, right from day one. And they knew that it's something that she absolutely loved. I mean, she was like everybody that's in that scene. I think Daredevil is what comes to mind. I don't think you go out on a single cable, you know, 100 feet over an open pit if you don't have some kind of a, you know, you're a thrill seeker. On that, and like most of the acrobats, you know, that's what they're risk takers, you know, and you want that because that's what brings the excitement on stage.
Yeah. You have told other reporters that Sarah Gilgiard would have wanted
absolutely
this to come back.
Yeah.
How did you know that?
Well, everybody knew how much she loved doing that act, and you know, she just had a zest for life, and she was like one of those kind of in your face kind of people, just loved doing it. So, like everybody that's in that act, so and everybody that worked with her friends. Everybody said she would have wanted that to come back into the show. Yeah. So we worked towards that, but we took a long time to make sure we had it right before we brought it back.
Did you ultimately seek the family's blessing, or did you make the decision?
We knew we were going to put it back in, but we've had their blessing all along. You know, we were very respectful of them. We were respectful of the time period we took before we started to talk about putting it back in. So it's almost a year and a half now, since the accident. So I think there's been a healthy amount of time that's gone through there. A lot of training for the performers going back into it. I mean, I think some of them would have rather have gone back the day we brought the show back, but that just wasn't going to happen on any level.
Cirque du Soleil expanded in Las Vegas at a time when giant casino resorts were showing up practically every year. Are there fewer opportunities to explore the kind of new creative avenues with the kinds of mega financing that brought O and Love and Ka?
I think if you look at where we are now and the time period that we're in now, I think that there's a healthy dose of, you know, if you build it, they will come. I think, you know, that there was an interesting, it was almost like the gold rush days of of this century back when we were doing all of those shows. So I think there's still a lot of interest in us doing bigger shows. I think there's a lot more research that goes into it, a lot more, you know, hey, if you build it, they will come attitude. Than it used to be there in the past. But there's still opportunity for us, absolutely. We get solicited constantly, I think at least once or twice a week, for people around the world wanting a Las Vegas-style show.
But you were able to design custom theaters, special theaters, around shows during this time. What's the new frontier for Cirque? Or is the new frontier Macau or some other such place?
Well, you know, we were in Macau. We went to Macau in 2008. Again, in 2008, we opened a show in August of 2008 in Macau. Not great timing there with what happened.
No.
But we were also the first major show to go into Macau. We worked with the Venetian and Sheldon Adelson's group, and he wanted a full-on integrated resort, everything that Las Vegas had to offer, their offering there, and entertainment was part of that. I think it was probably too big a show at the time to go in. We broke a lot of ground there, same way that we did when we went into Biloxi, Mississippi. We were the first big show to go into Biloxi when Steve went open the Beau Rivage. That was my first gig with Cirque. And it was an interesting time as you build a market and you're first in a market. But I think the new frontier is looking at those big opportunities aren't there like they are here. We've only ever been able to do a Vegas size and scale show here and in Orlando because of the concentration of tourists. But we just opened a show in Riviera Maya in Mexico with a group of Vedanta in a timeshare resort.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've got a new dinner club?
Yeah, so it's a permanent show. So I think for us, we had to get past our own version of a resident show is a Las Vegas style 75 performers, 100 technicians, mega show, to into the point where, okay, a resident show is a sit down, open ended run, permanent installation. So it's a cabaret style show, 27 performers, a few technicians, a 600 seat theater, 250 people for dinner, 400 additional seats if people just want to see a show. It's in the timeshare resort, so it's kind of have a built-in audience that gets in and out of there weekly, but it does not remotely have the size and scale or the running cost of one of the ones here. And it's frankly, something like this couldn't be sustained there. And we have a lot of interest from people in looking at that. So it opened in November. It got great reviews. It sold out until the end of January right now with the bookings that they have there. So you'll probably see us cropping up in other resort areas that are not necessarily with a mega show.
Yeah, I was going to say one interesting success in the last few years has been the show Absinthe, small scale, kind of old fashioned Spiegel tent.
Yeah.
Did the success of Absinthe tell you anything about the opportunities for that kind of small scale or smaller scale show in Las Vegas?
Well, we always knew that there was opportunities like that because shows like that have been out for a long time. I think we also have to look at what the brand Cirque du Soleil represents. There's been a lot more internal discussion and changes, frankly, within our own company to say, as much as we've wanted to say Cirque du Soleil stands for a quality entertainment production company, frankly, the audience has always thought when they see Cirque du Soleil, they think major acrobatics. Mm-hmm. So 2 years ago, or close to 3 years ago now, we produced the halftime show for the Super Bowl when Madonna did it. And nobody knew that we produced it. It got great reviews. She got great notices for it. The show itself was great, well received. If we had put the Cirque du Soleil name on it, I think it would have been a different critical reception because there was little to no acrobatics in it. So I think we're doing a lot more work, like we call it white label, where you won't see the Cirque du Soleil name on something, but we still get to use our creative energy on something. So
yeah, Absinthe, as you know, was produced by Spiegelworld. Would Cirque ever go into the kind of raunchy territory that Absinthe covers?
Well, I think there's a place for that. I think it's a lot of fun. And I think if you remember when Zumanity opened 10 years ago, we had a lot of people walking out of that show. We had at least 100 people a night walking out because it was raunchy. I mean, the humor was raunchy. We said we wanted to push the envelope on human sexuality. We tended to shred it, I think, when we opened the show. And, you know, we had to see what was resonating or not with the audiences. So the idea is to open people's minds, not necessarily offend them. So we changed that show quite a bit over the years.
The last 10 or 15 years, much of the brand of Cirque for people who have come to see shows and who are aware of what you do has been sort of the really big spectacular. Do you see the coming era of Cirque, maybe the next generation of Cirque, as being that kind of character? You said white label, but maybe smaller but more frequent?
I think you're going to see a hybrid of all of that. I think Vegas, people come here for a one-off kind of experience, right? So I think there's a place for what we do here, like the big mega-size shows. Certainly we have the one in Orlando, La Nuba in Orlando, that's the same way. But I think you also see us branching out into theater. You'll see smaller style dinner shows. I think you're going to see us producing revivals of musicals that may or may not have the Cirque name on it. There may be other things like Pippin was just here at the Smith Center, one of the touring show. Hmm. Diane Paulus, who directed that, also directed our tour of Amaluna a few years ago. And then she got to do Pippin, which always had a bit of a circus theme, but she went full on circus with it. So it's we're looking at different properties that have that ability to add Cirque style elements into it that could enhance a show and a revival and not just do a straightforward revival of some of the older
classics.
So
American musical theater classics with kind of a mashup in the Cirque du Soleil
twist. Yeah, absolutely. If you look at Pippin, it absolutely worked for that show.
Oh, sure.
So, we've always had our big top touring shows. They're kind of our ambassadors. That's what started the whole company off. We've taken those and put them in arenas and we've changed them into arena formats to get into markets where we wouldn't necessarily be able to take a big top show. So, I mean, we're selling about 15 million tickets a year. I think you'll probably see that grow over the years as well with other types of entertainment. So I'm not worried about Cirque fading off the horizon. But one thing I'll say for Guy is he's always said, you don't look behind you because it doesn't matter what you've done in the past. It matters what's coming up. So I think we've had our successes, but we're always looking down the road to see what else we could be doing.
Jerry Nadal is the Senior Vice President of Cirque du Soleil's Resident Shows Division. Jerry, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure being here. Thank you.